Good day, everybody. My name's Jack, and I am an alcoholic. I am assuming, I know that's a dangerous thing to do, but I'm assuming that the yellow tape was put up there so nobody would sit where the yellow tape is. So all of you in the "you can't tell me what to do" seats, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for allowing Bill to invite me to be here this evening. I think it's really important that you know who's responsible for my being here. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 3 hours that we're together, I want you to take that up with Bill. Because he's the one that's responsible for my being here. Now, if I happen to say anything that you agree with, please feel free to speak with me after the meeting because I could use those attaboys. I do come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. I do consider myself to be a member in good standing. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. My sponsor celebrated 30 years last night. I sponsor people. I have a service commitment in our group. If you're in Hagerstown, we meet on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and you're more than welcome to come look us up if you're in Hagerstown. It's really great to be here. My friend Chuck brought some folks along from North Carolina with him, and it was really good to see Bill and then their brother Leo. And Leo said if I mentioned his name three times from the podium, he'd give me $10. So Leo, that's really good to be with you, Leo. So I want to thank Bill also for having Jewel pick me up at the airport. Jewel, you in here somewhere? Oh, there you are. Okay. Jewel and I are told that we're leaving the airport and we're in that HOV lane doing 80 miles an hour. He says, if you want to stop and get something to eat, tell me where you want to stop. I said, how about the Varsity? I thought it said 55 miles an hour, but the rules don't apply to Jewel. So a lot of times at these AA things, they say if you have a cell phone with you, please turn it off. But if you're like me, you don't like being told what to do, so I usually do the opposite. So if you got a cell phone with you, by all means, turn that puppy on. And but if you wouldn't mind, especially if you're expecting a liver transplant, but if you wouldn't mind putting it on vibrate, that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. My mother is 93 years old. She'll be 94 years old next month. And I called her this afternoon to tell her where I was, remind her, and I was out of town. And she said, are you talking another one of those AA things? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. She said, you make sure you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic. Now, My mother was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. She knows what an alcoholic is. And I'm thinking maybe it's about time I started listening to my mom. It's very possible I've overreacted to this whole thing. When I first had enough of beverage alcohol to affect my relationship with the reality of my life, when I was actually affected by it, I knew immediately why my father drank. It was a shame that he couldn't control his drinking like I control mine, but it just seemed to me that it did for me. I'm sure it did for me what it did for you. Allowed me to do a lot of things that I couldn't do when I was not drinking. And it seemed to me it was the elixir of life. And I loved the effect produced by alcohol. And I chased that effect for a long time. I like to say that alcohol didn't have any negative impact on me when I was young, but I do have to tell you, as a result of good sponsorship, that I was 5 years in high school. I thought it was a result of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but it turns out it was the drinking. And when I got out of high school, I went to our local community college. My friend Bill and I had decided we were going to take off a month, and we were going to drive to California, and we bought 12 cases of beer, and we each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you needed for a trip to California. And the night before we were to leave, his father told him he couldn't go. And I was crushed, but Bill was a stand-up guy, and he gave me his half interest in those 12 cases of beer. And as many of you know, the state of Maryland has a part of its eastern border that is on the Atlantic Ocean. We have a resort community there called Ocean City, Maryland, and I went down to Ocean City, and I spent a month there living as a bum. And I enjoyed myself so much that month in Ocean City that I decided I wanted to work in Ocean City. But I'm a keen observer of my surroundings, and I noticed that if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted over the course of 3 months, it didn't make any difference if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a bartender or a waiter or a waitress or a bellhop or a clerk in a hotel. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, there was a real good chance you'd get arrested. I did not want to get arrested. So I did observe, however, there was a group of people who drank like I drank and acted like I acted, and they were not getting arrested. And they were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. Chuck, I'm gonna put my watch up here, not because I can really see it or pay any attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer, you know? My first year as an Ocean City police officer, they gave me a boardwalk beat, and within a matter of a week or 10 days, it became apparent that I possess a singularly unique talent that's very helpful to a person like me as a police officer. And that is, I can spot an underage drinker from about 100 yards. And if you were my target of opportunity, you and I would have a conversation. I would establish that you were underage, and I'd ask what's in the cooler. And you'd tell me you had some Coca-Cola in there, a little thing of Tupperware with tuna fish, and a half a loaf of bread. And I'd ask you, could we look in the cooler? Well, certainly. We lift the lid to the cooler, and there's those 6 or 8 Coca-Colas right there, and that crushed ice, and a little thing of Tupperware with the tuna fish, half a loaf of bread. And I'd reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably, I'd come up with a Budweiser. And if you were that underage drinker, your life, as you've known it, has just ended. I know, you thought you were going to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. You're going to the Ocean City Jail, and no college, no self-respecting college, is going to have anything to do with you when they find out you've been in the Ocean City Jail. Now, maybe the military was on your horizon, but that ain't happening. The United States military does not need jailbirds like you. They find out you've been in the Ocean City Jail, you will not be going in the military. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm going to tell them, you've been locked up in Ocean City Jail, and they're going to have to come down here and get you out. Say what? You want to offer an alternative? A compromise. Well, what did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration, but you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm going to take the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? All right, well, now you have to promise me. You have to give me your word that you are never, ever going to do something like this again in Ocean City. You promise me? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it is really difficult to walk a beat on the boardwalk when you're dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and my sergeant, and they would come with their squad car as I accumulated the coolers, and they would collect them at the end of the shift. I would meet with them, and if I had gotten any whiskey or wine, I'd give it to the lieutenant and sergeant, and I would keep the cooler full of beer and the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. I had a really good summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I did not get arrested, and that's my definition of a good summer. I had such a good summer, I decided I want to go back for a second summer. And the second summer I went back, they gave me a squad car. Lights and sirens, yep, the whole deal. One of them big old Ford Crown Victorias. You know, you ever look at the trunks on one of those things? You can get three bodies or five coolers in there. And that expanded my territory, and I didn't really need my lieutenant and my sergeant, but they kept a keen eye on my activities, and I would meet them at the end of every shift, turn over the whiskey and the wine if I had any. I kept the coolers and the beer. If you were down in Ocean City and you were a friend of mine, or if you were a friend of a friend of mine, and you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I mean, I got coolers stacked up to the ceiling of my porch, and I got a no-return policy. So you take whatever cooler you want, and you have a great time while you're in Ocean City. Just don't get arrested. And I had a good summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. So I'm on a roll now, so I go back for a third summer. Got my squad car back, and I'm a college kid, and I really don't have any plans for my life. I don't know what I want to do. I mean, I'm just going to the University of Maryland, and I'm kind of drinking my way through as best I can. And so on this, I'm going to tell you about an event that changed the entire course of my life. And I'm on the beach highway at 3 o'clock in the morning. I stopped this car. The guy's drunk. I got him out. I'm writing him up. He's obviously drunk, and he says to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county that you're standing in right now." Well, like I said, I'm a college kid. I don't know what a state's attorney is. I've never heard of the term state's attorney. I don't have any idea of what they do. So I say, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." And he signed a ticket, and there was a guy there who seemed to be sober, and I let him drive, and they went on their way. And I finished off my shift, and 8 o'clock pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department, and there was the chief of police. And he said to me, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. This is a good thing. I'm about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. So I go up to his office, and I walk into his office, and lo and behold, sitting right inside the door on the couch is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief says, "Give me that book." And I gave him the book, and he flips it open to the ticket. He hands the ticket book to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch pulls out a pen, and he writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signs his name. It was at that moment that I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, I definitely want to be one of those state's attorneys. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges by just signing your name was going to come in mighty handy. And so I went to law school. My wife and I got married while I was in law school, and then when I got out of law school, we went back to practice law. In a matter of 6 or 8 weeks, I became aware that they had a vacancy in the state's attorney's office for an assistant state's attorney. I went right over. "Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start?" Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I... Yeah. You may have experienced this in your own life, I don't know. Turns out many things that I thought were said to me were never said. Many things that I thought I saw happen never really happened the way I thought I saw them happen. I have a disease of perception. I have a hearing problem. I don't hear things right. So this is what I thought I heard them say. What? You're some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never made an opening statement or closing argument. You've never done anything. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, upon reflection, I believe they said something to the effect that the job had already been filled. But I heard what I heard, and I am a very sensitive person. And I was wounded. I was hurt. I was angered. I now know I had a resentment. And we in Maryland, like you all here in Georgia, we elect our prosecutors. I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney. He made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And they give you a badge case for that badge, and they have a clear glass scene window there. You put your driver's license right behind it. And when they pull you over and they come up and they ask for that license and registration, you just show them your badge case. They don't look at the driver's license. They look at the badge. Oh, the badge officer, deputy state's attorney, Washington County. Well, no, I am not upset, sir, that you stopped me. No, I understand. You're just doing your job. Mm-hmm. I may have had 4 or 5. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I only have a few more miles to go. I believe I can stay on my side of the road. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the professional courtesy that you're extending to me, officer. Yes, sir. And you have a nice night, too. Thank you so much. Now, some of you may be gaining a little insight into why I've never been arrested or had an alcohol-related offense. But it does get better. My boss, the state's attorney, was to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I'm going to get appointed state's attorney. Now, I don't know how it is in Georgia, but back in Maryland, every now and then, the local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws everything up, and that's what happened in this case. And somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. And I was disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of upset that I didn't get appointed state's attorney. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was determined that something needed to be done with that state's attorney. State senator. He needed to be taught a lesson. So somebody has to run against him for the state senate. Who can we get to do that? So I volunteered. Now, I did not know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and children, and move to Florida. But he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate. That license plate says, State Senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going, and they get up close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. And they come up alongside of you, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of the Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly when they could be out arresting real crooks. Now, that guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job, and he quit. So I went over to see the governor. I said, "Governor, I would like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney, circuit court judge." The governor said, "Can't do that. There was too much adverse publicity associated with that last appointment up there in Hagerstown, and I will not, cannot appoint your friend. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you." Well, it's a 15-year term in Maryland, and they only had two of them in our community, so I became a circuit court judge. I know, it's a scary proposition. It really is. But I love drinking. I love everything about drinking. I'm the bar drinker. Maybe some bar drinkers in here. I don't know how you did it, but I was reminded about this a couple of, last year. I go in and I sit down at the bar, and I take my watch off, and I put it up here. And I pay for that first drink with a $20 bill, and they bring me a stack of change, put my change over here. Take my wallet out, because sitting on that bar stool, it's uncomfortable. I put my wallet up there on the bar. I got my drink all the way down to just a little bit left in it, and I got to go to the bathroom. And what do I say to the guy next to me? "Don't let him take my drink." And I go to the bathroom. I leave my watch, my wallet, my money on the bar, but don't let them take my drink. I don't know why we do that. I love the neon lights. I love the way the lights play off the back bar mirror. I love the shape of all the different bottles and all the colors of the different bottles, the tans, the browns, the darks, the clears, the greens, the yellows. I mean, I love the peanuts on the floor, the sawdust. I love the smell of stale beer and urine. I mean, I love everything about drinking. And by the way, with that Cosby thing, I mean, did that bring back memories? Is there anything like porcelain on a fevered brow? I mean, I'm telling you. Oh, man, I miss that. Woo! I love everything about drinking. I would drink top shelf, bottom shelf. I drink imported. I drink domestic. I prefer a twist-off cap, but all you got's got a cork in it. We'll work with that. We'll be patient. We'll get it out. I love the stemware. I love the glassware. I like those thin, frosted Tom Collins glasses. Those little squat old-fashioned glasses. I like those long-stem fluted glasses for the gin martini. I mean, where can you get olives like that? I mean, I've never seen olives anyplace except gin martinis like that. And I had a love affair at one time with the gin martini. But I have to tell you, I had a really bad gin experience. And even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. And my drink of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label and crushed ice with twist of lemon. That's what I love that. Just love that. But if you came up to me and shoved a brown paper bag at me and said, "Here, Jack, take a pull on that," I would never, ever ask you what was in that bag. Because you would not offer it to me if it wasn't good. And, good stuff. Good stuff. Whew, man. And you know how you have folks over to the house maybe to play some cards or watch a ball game or something, and now everybody's left and you're cleaning up and there's cans all around and you're picking them up, and whoo, this one's got a little something in it. And my goodness, what was that? You're right, cigarette butt. Yeah. I knew there were some cigarette butt drinkers in here. I could tell that last night. Well, April the 7th, 1982, a lawyer friend of mine and I were going out. We told my wife we were going out to dinner, but what we were going to do is we were going out to get drunk. This was not one of those occasions where I negligently allowed myself to be overserved. The stated purpose of going out was to get drunk, knee-walking, snot-flying drunk, and I want you to know we achieved our purpose. And we ended up in a local honky-tonk. And had I known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I can assure you that I would have ordered something else. And if I'd have had any idea, any inkling of an idea, that I was going to have to come down to Georgia, to the Rock, to tell you folks about my last drink of beverage alcohol, I would have ordered something else. Because as you're about to hear, there is a considerable amount of embarrassment and a degree of shame associated with what I'm about to tell you. My last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. How do you think I feel? It's embarrassing. And I heard a voice over here say, "What's that?" And I can tell that some others don't know what Tia Maria is. And believe me, you don't want to know. If you've got any idea about going back out, go back out for something else, but don't go back out for Tia Maria. You'll be sorely disappointed. In fact, I would suggest to you that if you're here, why don't you just stay here? I mean, if you're here by mistake, stay here anyway. One thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that there is nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that's designed to hurt me. Any pain that I've ever experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my resistance to the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's had nothing to do with the program itself. It's a lot better to be in here by accident than by mistake than to be out there. Because in here, we get to live. Out there, we suffer and die. So, even if you think you're here by mistake, and even if you don't know what Tia Maria is, stick around. My wife is a school teacher. She teaches elementary school. And I don't know how it is here in Georgia, but back in Maryland, elementary school children are just germ-encrusted. And them little kids, they get up close to their teachers, and those germs jump off on the teachers. And then the teachers come home, and the germs jump off on the spouse of the teacher. And the next morning I got up, I had flu. I couldn't believe it. Those pesky little kids had done it to me one more time. But we go to work, flu or no flu, we go to work. Because if we don't go to work, somebody might say that our drinking is affecting our work. So I went to work. And I came home, and the next day was Good Friday, so I didn't have to go to work. And I had developed that upset stomach thing that frequently accompanies flu. And by Saturday, I had that lower tract of stress thing going on. And if you got that lower tract of stress thing going on with that upset stomach thing, that will hone your decision making down to a really fine edge. And I didn't know whether to kneel or sit or sit or kneel. And at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. And if my wife were here, you could talk to her about that, but I'm going to go on. Sunday was Easter Sunday, and on Easter Monday, they put me in the hospital. I was dehydrated from all that sitting and kneeling that I had been doing. And that night, my abdomen became distended, and they had to do an emergency laparotomy on me, and they opened me up, and they found my abdomen to be full of gangrene, peritonitis. And while they were trying to clean that up, they discovered that my liver was enlarged and the enzymes were out of whack. My pancreas was digesting itself, my kidneys quit, and my respiratory system quit. So things just weren't looking too good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital, and they got me off the respirator, but everything else was deteriorating. And they said they were going to send me down to Baltimore to Johns Hopkins. Now, I was encouraged by that Because I knew people who had gone to the Hagerstown Hospital and they died. And there were other people that I knew had gone to Johns Hopkins and they'd lived. So I thought this was a good thing. Now, they told my wife that they were sending me to Johns Hopkins to die. They didn't think there was anything that could be done to improve my condition. And they told her that she just should make plans for my not returning. Now, I'm glad they didn't tell me that, because I'd have found that discouraging. And I went down to Johns Hopkins, and for 2 weeks they did everything down there but hang me by my thumbs. And they came in and they told me that they had presented my case to the internal medicine department and that they couldn't get a majority vote on what was wrong with me. And I told them, I said, tomorrow's my birthday, please, for God's sake, just give me a day of rest. And they said, well, that's why we're here. We've told you we don't know what else to do for you, so we're going to give you a day of rest. And so I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital on May 14th. 2 weeks later, on May 28th, I was discharged from Johns Hopkins Hospital. My liver got back right-sized, my pancreas stopped digesting itself, and my kidney function returned. And when you've been 7 weeks in a hospital like that, they like to talk to you before they send you home about the do's and don'ts, about what to stay away from so you don't come back. But if you've got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you. Now, it was my position that it is much better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. That was my feeling then, and that's my feeling now. And they told me, Judge, we don't know what was wrong with you, but we just suggest you not get it again because it's liable to kill you. And so I was just about out the door of that doctor's office when the other doctor said to me, could we ask you one more question? I said, certainly. They said, do you drink? Yeah, what kind of question is that? I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer, now I'm a judge. When I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I drank with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers, and I drink with other judges. It is a matter of professional obligation. How much do you drink? Not much. Why do you ask? Well, we just think you should not drink for a while because your kidneys are working now, and alcohol just destroys the kidneys. We don't know what had happened if you drank any alcohol to your pancreas. And, of course, nothing destroys the liver like alcohol does. And you got these three very vital, very sensitive organs involved. And we should just think you should not drink for a while. How long? A year. A year. Well, I haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. Well, let's see. I think I could probably do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know there are men in this audience right now who have already discerned the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me. But I'm getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. Well, an argument broke out between these two learned physicians and this knuckle-headed judge as to when I would get to drink next. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then, if I thought any of the pain, suffering, and misery which I had just endured had anything at all to do with drinking, that I would not drink until June the 1st. And with that, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. Not drinking, not changing. No one said anything about alcoholism. Not drinking, not changing. Now, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says when you take alcohol away from the alcoholic gets restless, irritable, and discontented. That is a gross understatement in my case. I became pissed off in the spring-loaded position. And with each passing day, of each passing week, of each passing month, of each passing year, that I did not drink. That was proof positive that I do not have a drinking problem, because people who are alcoholics, they drink. And I'm not drinking, okay? So I am, by definition, not alcoholic. I think we can all agree to that. And as a matter of fact, I'll admit, okay, I'm a little on edge, all right? I'm a little prickly. But let me tell you something. If you would just mind your own darn business and stay away from me, okay? Why don't you just shut up and do what I tell you to do, and you and I will get along just fine. Because I'm fine, okay? Things are fine. Leo, how'd you like to have your DWI in front of me on Monday morning, huh? We're fine. Fine. Not drinking and not changing. That's almost like don't drink and go to meetings. I hope that you people in Georgia do not tell people don't drink and go to meetings. We kill alcoholics by telling them don't drink and go to meetings. It is real clear. All the evidence is in. When alcoholics stop drinking is when the problems show up. And we either are going to have to drink again, slow suicide, or drive into a bridge abutment, fast suicide. That's it. Unless we experience a total psychic change, as the doctor describes it, keeping in mind he's not alcoholic, or a vital spiritual experience, as our book describes it, we're doomed. That is not encouraging. Now, if you're here, and you're new, and you're alcoholic, and you're not drinking, and going to meetings, and that's all you're doing, bend over, grab your ankles, and kiss your ass goodbye, because you're doomed. But if you've got this problem that I've got, we've got a solution. And that is get a sponsor, get a big book, read the book, do what it says, sponsor other people, and recover in Alcoholics Anonymous and learn how to live happy, joyous, and free, not drinking. If you tell people that, that works. Well, I'm not drinking and I'm not changing. My alcoholic father, who was married to my mom for 30 years, on July the 3rd, 1968, walked by a church in Hagerstown where the minister put the following message out on the board. Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth. My dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and he never drank again. And when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And I owe a great deal of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. I carry his 15-year chip with my token, and I try in some small way to pay back to Alcoholics Anonymous the tremendous gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gave my father. He lost that 30-year marriage to my mom. He lost the respect of my sister and myself. He lost a business that he had spent 35 years building from scratch. He lost his integrity. He lost his self-esteem. He lost everything of material value and all of the priceless stuff. And he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you gave him back the priceless stuff. You gave him back his dignity. You gave him back his self-esteem. He became a man of integrity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had two friends, Ken and Bob, who were active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they knew my dad. And they came to me, and they said, Bob said, we have this book in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. And we thought you'd like to read it to find out about your dad's illness. Clever guy, that, Bob. I think if he'd have said anything remotely close to, we think you ought to read this book to find out what's wrong with you, I think we've already established there's nothing wrong with me. But I was interested in finding out what was wrong with my dad. And so I read that book. My dad's in there. He was a real alcoholic, as defined by the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not surprised to see him in there. But what did surprise me, and apparently it didn't surprise Bob or Ken, I'm in there. Now, I hadn't counted on that. I think Bob and Ken had counted on it, but I hadn't counted on it. That book was written before I was born. And yet they describe things in that book that have happened to me. I saw things written in that book that I had experienced. I saw described feelings which I had felt. I was amazed. And I told Ken and I told Bob that I was willing to concede that there was a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism, but we caught it just in time. Well, that's all Ken and Bob needed. They started to come to my chambers, that is my judge's office, every Friday at noon, and they brought their big books with them and a brown bag lunch. And I had my big book, and we would meet around my conference table, and we'd eat our lunches, we'd pray the Serenity Prayer, and then we would read from the big book. And then Bob and Ken would explain to me the importance of what we had read, and then I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And as you might imagine, we had many very high-level intellectual discussions there in my office. And I thought it was important that Bob and Ken be aware, as I think it's important that you all should be aware, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I went to community college and got an associate's degree in 2 years. And I went down to University of Maryland College Park and I got a bachelor's degree down there in 2 more years. And then I went to the University of Maryland School of Law, where I received a Juris Doctorate with honors, I might add, in 3 years. And Ken said, "Jack, we have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them." He said that in my office. I didn't care for that. I've heard that a lot in AA, but I'd never heard it before then, that's for sure. You see, Ken and Bob were willing to risk offending me because they knew that I'd been offended before and that I'd get over it. They were also willing to anger me because they knew that I'd been angry before and I'd get over it. But I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. And if something doesn't change, something doesn't change soon, I'll die of untreated alcoholism. And I won't get over that. You see, Ken and Bob knew something that I didn't know. And I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. In addition to knowing something that I didn't know, they also knew that if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know and I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know would make me angry. But they were willing to make me angry because they knew that just because I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know didn't mean that there would come a point in time when I would actually know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And when I found out what they knew that I didn't know and I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know, the fact that I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know that they knew, would no longer make me angry because now I would know what they knew that I know, and they knew that in AA you know when you know that you know and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. But if you found it to be the least bit confusing, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. On December 22nd, 1989, it was a Friday. It was Friday before Christmas. The courthouse was closed. Bob and Ken and I could not have our big book meeting in my office, so we went out to have a Christmas lunch together. And let me say this, that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions. And there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions. And there were women involved. Now, I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six separations, and we didn't know. So on this particular day, Friday, December the 22nd, my wife and I were separated yet again. And when I left lunch with Ken and Bob, I went back to my apartment where a mailman had walked up three flights of steps and had propped a package against my door. And it was one of those Hickory Farms boxes that you frequently see only at Christmas time. Somebody had sent the judge a cheese log or a sausage. I thought, this is very nice. And I'll go in and have a little snack. And so I go into my apartment, and I'm taking the answers off my answering machine, because you see, I have plans for that Friday night. And I have plans for the next day. I got plans for Christmas Eve. I got plans for Christmas Day. I have plans for New Year's. I got plans for well into 1990. And so I'm taking the messages off my answering machine. I slip the tape on this box with my car keys, and as I'm listening to the messages, I lift the lid of the box. Boom! And I got blown back against the wall. Now, about 10 days before, a federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed by a package bomb that was sent to his home. And about 5 days before, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a package bomb and sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew I'd opened a bomb. I'd been blown back against the wall, and there was a fire. I tried to put it out. I couldn't. So I went out in the hallway, and I pulled the fire alarm, and my neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. And I went back in my apartment, and I went to call 911, and when I went to punch the buttons on the phone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And after I hung up the phone, I looked down on the floor. It felt like somebody was trying to pull my pants off my hips. And I looked down on the floor, and I'm standing in a puddle of blood, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I'm looking at it. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor came, he put the fire out, and he's asked if there's anything else he could do. And I asked him to get me a towel. And I opened my trousers, and I put the towel where I thought I'd been wounded. I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And I could feel my life ebbing away. I was alone. I was powerless. And I was terribly frightened. And I didn't know what to do. And all those meetings that Ken and Bob and I had had on those Fridays, we started every meeting with a serenity prayer. So I reached for the only tool I had. And I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change. To give me the courage to change what I could and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer. And I don't know if it was the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh time through that prayer, but I can tell you this, God came. And the prayer was answered. And I experienced a peace and comfort, the likes of which I had never experienced before in my life. nor have I ever experienced it again. I didn't know if I was going to live or die. But I knew that if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife and our three children again, it'd be all right. Be all right. The police, fire, and rescue people burst through the door of my apartment, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and I was really having a tough time hearing what they were saying, and I stopped praying so I could communicate with them, and this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and I told those guys, I said, you do whatever you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I have to do, and I went back to the serenity prayer, and as soon as I did, that sense of peace and well-being returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks, and they strapped me on a backboard and strapped me on a gurney and carried me down three flights of steps and carried me out to an ambulance, and our local TV station was Johnny on the Spot, and they got a picture of me stuffed into that ambulance with my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of the ambulance, and that picture of my red and green Christmas socks went around the world on CNN, and I went to the hospital to be prepared for surgery. They couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken, and they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And Ken took my hand, and he prayed for me, and we prayed together. And they took me up to surgery, and I can only tell you what they told me is that they removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. And they took, I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop passing through flesh. I don't know. They took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. And Bob was smiling. Now let me say this. It's good to have a sponsor. Sponsors see things differently. Sponsors have a different take on what's going on. If you're new here and you don't have a sponsor, there are men who are eminently qualified to be your sponsor. Do yourself a favor and get a sponsor before you leave and go home this weekend. We're not asking you to get married. We're just asking you to get a sponsor. Somebody is going along the path ahead who can reach his hand back, and you can take his hand and follow the path that we have walked so you can get what we got. And maybe you're here and you've been around a while, and maybe you had a sponsor, maybe your sponsor and you have grown apart, maybe your sponsor's moved away, maybe he's passed on, maybe you're doing that I sponsor myself, the ism of alcoholism. If you're here tonight and you're sponsoring yourself, I don't mean to be unkind, and I certainly don't mean to be rude, but you got an idiot for a sponsor. I said to Bob, "Bob, I notice that you're smiling." He said, "Yes." He said, "I think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." I said, "Bob, somebody just tried to kill me." He said, "Yes, Jack, I understand. I know they tell me that that package that you opened contained four pipe bombs. One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is a little redundant. Three pipe bombs is around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, I think you have really made somebody very angry." He said, "Jack, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God." But it's good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, "Jack, God has spared you for a purpose. He has worked for you." I said, "Really, Bob? And what kind of work does God have for me?" He said, "Oh, Jack," he said, I wouldn't be so presumptive as to guess as to what God's will for you is in that area. But he said, "I do know this. It's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either Ken or myself. Do that fourth step inventory. Take that fifth step with me or with Ken. Make that sixth step decision. Pray that seventh step prayer. Make that eighth step list. Begin making those ninth step amends so you can live to good order in 10, 11, and 12 and fit yourself to be a maximum service to God and to your fellow man. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. I got out of the Washington County Hospital on Christmas Day, 1989. Best Christmas I'd ever had up until that point. Christmas of 1990, my wife and I reconciled, and we've been together ever since. And each successive Christmas has exceeded the Christmas before. And if you would have asked me in December of 2008 if I thought 2008 could be exceeded or improved upon in any way, I would have told you I don't see how it could be possible that I would have a better year in 2009 than I did in 2008. And yet here we are, halfway through the month of March, and 2009 has already exceeded 2008. I am excited about what the rest of 2009 holds for me. I get to live happy, joyous, and free in this wonderful program. And if you're here tonight and you're not happy, joyous, and free, get with your sponsor and find out what it is that you are not doing that you ought to be doing. Or find out what it is that you are doing that you shouldn't be doing. Because that book says that each and every one of us are guaranteed happy, joyous, and free. It's not 1 out of 10, or 5 out of 10, or 8 out of 10. It's 10 out of 10. We are guaranteed a life that is happy, joyous, and free. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. But when I first came here, if you'd opened up your Webster's, looked under Glumlot, you would have seen my picture there. I'll grant you that. But that's not the way it is today. Because when I got out of that hospital, I started to do a few things that I had never done before. But I was in the book it says, some of us bristle with antagonism when things of God or religion are mentioned. And that was me. And Bob said, "What's your problem, Jack?" I said, "Well, when I was 14, I prayed that my dad would stop drinking. And he and I had a discussion, and he agreed that he would stop drinking. And I knew that this was an answer to prayer. And when my mom and my sister came home, I told them that our problems were over, that Dad and I have had a discussion, and he's agreed to stop drinking. And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. And the next day, my dad got drunk. And that's the day I closed the door on God. I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that would play fast and loose with the prayers of a 14-year-old boy. Evidently, either I was not adequate or my prayers were not adequate, but it came readily apparent to me that if I was going to amount to anything in this life, I was going to have to be self-sufficient. It was going to have to be me. I was going to have to do it all on my own. And I began to worship at that altar of self-sufficiency. And Bob said, "How old were you when your dad stopped drinking?" I said, 26. He says, "Let's see, you were 14 when you prayed that he stopped drinking, 26 when he stopped drinking." He said, "Jack, do you have any idea what 12 years means to infinite God?" Good to have a sponsor. never thought about that. He said, "Well, Jack, 12 years to infinite God is an infinitesimal period of time. As a matter of fact, you got pretty quick service. What is your complaint?" He said, "Tell me about the God of your understanding." I said, "Well, the God of my understanding sits on high on a throne. He has on an ermine robe. He's got a long white beard. He's got a clipboard, and he's got my name on it, and he's putting black marks next to my name. And by the time I was 14 or 15, there were more black marks on that board than I could ever get back even. He said, what kind of God would you like to have? I said, I'd like to have a loving, caring, gracious, forgiving God that wants only the best for me. And he said, well, Jack, you can have that God, and you can have a personal relationship with that God if you're just willing to take certain steps. So we began to get into action. I now know that when Bob and Ken and I were meeting in my chambers, my judge's office on those Fridays, and we read the big book and had those intellectual discussions, that what I had was what I like to call today cake mix sobriety. And by that I mean if we were to go over to a local grocery store and get a box of Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix, Duncan Hines on the back of that package has put a 3-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. Now if I had one of those boxes here tonight, I could read step 1 out loud to you from the podium and we could discuss it. I could give the box to Chuck and he could read step 2 and we could discuss that. And then maybe we could give it to Jerry and he could read step 3. And I'm the kind of guy that having read the back of the box, I'm looking for my red velvet cake. I mean, I have read the box. Where's my cake? I've been meeting with Bob and with Ken in my office, reading the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm looking around for my recovery. Haven't done a damn thing. Just read the box. Where's my recovery? Where's my cake? Haven't broken an egg. Haven't done anything, no cake. Haven't taken any action on the steps, no recovery. My favorite chapter in the big book for the longest time was the chapter into thinking. I know there are people here. There are people in this room right now that's your favorite chapter. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. It's not about the drinking, it's about the thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. Now we have this pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called "Is AA for You?" And as many of you know, the people up at General Services are always interested in suggestions of how they can improve our literature and rewrite our pamphlets. And I've written to them with suggestions on some new questions for a new pamphlet. I'm going to try them out here. You let me know how you receive them. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so and only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? If you found that resonating with you, write to General Services and tell them you support Jack's draft of the Thinking Man's pamphlet. I was out at Akron for Founders Day, and I was on the meal program where you stay in the dormitory and you eat in the dining hall, and on Saturday at breakfast, lunch, and dinner you go through the buffet line and then they tell you where to sit. You sit every chair, you can't leave any chairs vacant. And then when your side of the big long line gets filled up, they bring them down the other side, and somebody new sits across from you at every meal. And, you know, you don't know who it's going to be, and you meet new friends and that sort of thing. And I'd been out there with Glenn, and we'd done the breakfast, lunch, and dinner thing on Saturday. Now it's Sunday morning, and I'm down in the bathroom of the men's dormitory, and guy comes through the door and he says, "Hi, I'm Woody. I'm from Baltimore." And I said, "Well, hi, Woody. I'm Jack from Hagerstown." He said, "Oh, I come up to Hagerstown all the time." And I thought, well, he's probably a truck driver. And I said, "What do you come to Hagerstown for, Woody?" He says, "Well, me and my sponsor, we come up from Baltimore. We bring a meeting up to that prison in Hagerstown. We come up there once a month." I said, "Woody, I am embarrassed to say that I live 10 miles from that prison, and I don't know a single person that takes a meeting into that prison." He said, "Really? Would you like to go with us?" "I'd really like to talk to you about that, Woody, but I got to meet my guy Glenn back in the room, and maybe we'll talk about that sometime in the future." I went back to the room and I told Glenn what had happened. He said, "Did you give him your telephone number?" I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Jack, there are 15,000 people here. He will never find you." And I took comfort in that. So we went over to breakfast and we went through the buffet line, and now we're taking our seats, sit down, every chair. Oh, they're coming down the other side now. I wonder who's going to sit across from me. Woody. Not over there, but right directly in front of me. And he says to his sponsor, there's the guy who wants to go into the prison with us. Now you can imagine, as a retired circuit court judge, the last thing I want to do is to take meetings into prisons. But this isn't about what I want to do. This is about what is God's will for Jack. And I may be a knucklehead, but I recognize God's hand when it moves. And so I began taking meetings into prisons. And it's one of the best things that I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been to prison. I've never been arrested. I don't even have a good tattoo. But they're not interested in that. What they're interested in is how to live sober. How to live sober successfully. Because you see, that was my problem. I didn't know how to do sober. I drank because I didn't know how to do sober. I mean, in that Cosby thing, the reason, and you know this, the reason we go out on Friday night, that we've been sober all week. And we don't do sober well. And we go into the bar and we say to the bartender, "Give me a drink, make it two and keep them coming." And we slam them down and now, whew, man. We're feeling better now. Take the edge off. I don't know how to do sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me how to live happy, joyous, and free not drinking. I had to do stuff I didn't want to do. I had to start taking meetings into prisons. Ken, my sponsor, told me, "Jack, if you want to get what we got, you got to do what we do. If you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always gotten. If you want something you've never had, you got to do stuff you've never done." And they got numbers in front of them. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We have a way of life here. It is a way of life that works. I got a warehouse full of evidence of a life that does not work. And yet I want to hang on to my old ideas. Because you see, they are my ideas. Now, you may have some old ideas of your own, and quite frankly, you're suck. But my old ideas, by God, they're mine. And they may be a little bit sucky, but they're mine. What am I going to do if I let go of that stuff? Well, what happens, of course, is I get stuff I've never had before by doing stuff I've never done before. I think it's just remarkable. You know, an awful lot of people, and I'm sure you know some that are, you know, not members of Alcoholics Anonymous, not don't have any qualifications for Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're going to gather up tomorrow, and they're going to wonder if God exists. And we gather up, and we get to watch God work on a daily basis. And there are going to be discussions tomorrow in churches around this country asking whether or not the Age of Miracles was 2,000 years ago. And you and I know the Age of Miracles is now. Right now. So many wonderful things have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Time really doesn't permit me to talk about them, but the longer I'm here, the less I know. But here's something I know for sure, which is that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today because somebody prayed. Actually, a number of somebodies prayed. My wife prayed. Our three children prayed. My mom, who doesn't think I'm alcoholic, she just thinks I'm crazy. And she prayed that God would send somebody to help her boy Jack. And there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that I am in Alcoholics Anonymous today as a direct result of prayer. And if you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic and you're here tonight, you're here because somebody prayed. Now maybe you offered up that alcoholic prayer that we so often offer up. God, please help me. I can't take it anymore. Maybe your wife or your husband or your mom or your dad or your brother or your sister or your children or your employer or your neighbor or your friend prayed. Maybe they all prayed. Now you may not believe that and you may not like that, and quite frankly it really doesn't make any difference because it is true. And that's the problem with the truth. The truth is the truth. Whether I like it or not, whether I believe it or not, it is the truth. And people who find their way and make their way to Alcoholics Anonymous do so as a direct result of prayer. And I think many of you know that the vast majority of alcoholics die of alcoholism and they never, ever hear of Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone get here. So we're here. So let's stay here. Now here's something that I think we can all agree upon without any argument or dispute. And that is that the people who are sitting in this auditorium at this moment right here have never been assembled together before in the history of the world, and we will never, ever be assembled together again. And our book says that there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here, right now. Think of all the twists and turns that your life had to take to bring you to this moment in time, right here, right now. And think of all the twists and turns that my life had to take to bring me to this moment in time, right here, right now. Now, there's somebody in this audience tonight who had absolutely no intention on being here. And yet you're here. You are here. It is not by accident that you are here. We are not assembled here by accident. There are a number of people here who have been sent here to hear something. I do not know what you were sent here to hear. Maybe it was something that Ralph said last night. Maybe it's something that's been said here tonight. Maybe it's something that Terry's going to say. Maybe it's for you. Maybe it's for that new sponsee that God is preparing to send your way next week or next month. Maybe it's to take back to somebody at your home group, or maybe it's just something for you and you alone. But you are not here by chance. You're not here by accident. We have a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think this is the finest piece of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous outside of the Big Book. That is my opinion. If you have read this pamphlet, then you have your own opinion. I don't need to know your opinion. If you have not read this pamphlet, you don't have an opinion. So why don't you get a copy of this and read it, and then you'll have an opinion. I'm going to read the very end of this pamphlet. This coming Sunday, tomorrow, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst. And that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into AA. If they were here tonight and they were to ask me, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. As my good friend Ed used to say, I love each and every one of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Thank you.